Understood. And the title of this on the board is Who Cares? No, Who Knows?
Who Cares?
Who Cares? Okay. And those were not titles, those were just expressions of some reality. Yesterday, Who Knows? And today, Who Cares? I'm going to do a little repeat today on a formula that I presented, last week, I guess, sometime, on fear and guilt and hostility. And if you heard that one before, you can better spend your time and listen to it again. But first, I'm going to be among the unemployed in about 50 minutes. I've had 2 weeks here now, and it's time to get home and pet my dogs. I'm sure they're lonesome, as I'm sure I am for them. It has been one great, fantastic 2 weeks. Over the years, and it's 23 years since I first came here, Leo and I were on that first faculty. You heard Leo somebody this morning. And we've been coming ever since pretty regularly. Leo more regularly than I have. I've got one thing on him. I spent one whole year here, and he hasn't spent that much in one continuous stretch. Every time we've been here, it has been good to be here. It has been good to be here this time. Holden is a place where you dance with strangers. I taught a group here a few days ago, a little verse that my daughter gave to us shortly before she died. And it runs like this. Remember the word from the manger. It means simply this, you can dance with a stranger. Which is a rather nice way of stating those profound truths of the incarnation. And we've been dancing with strangers, so I have, for these 2 weeks. We've had some wondrous moments out when before the rains came and the clouds, watching Jupiter come out, popping out from behind Buckskin every night at just exactly the right time, precisely on schedule, never misses. There it is. And then to see the moons and see them change places every night, because the thing, those moons keep running around. And to watch the moon go from full, which isn't very nice, that's a moon. All people who own telescopes hate the full moon. They don't like the moon at all under any circumstances, but surely not full moon, because it knocks out all the stars. You probably see 1 in 100 when it's full up there, as you probably have noticed. But then as the moon started to fade a little bit, on the side, and the shadow comes across it. And along that terminator, the craters start to become three-dimensional and stand out. And a telescope is a way of bringing in sort of an intimacy. If you can see the details, you know it a little bit better, don't you? You feel a little bit closer to it. So at 2:30 in the morning, to have somebody just start humming the second verse of Beautiful Savior was quite a thing, you know, in the middle of the night. That second or third verse, you can't tell from the humming, but it was the one the one that has to do with, you know, the heart. And the one who is fairer than the moonlight and all the stars on high. And then to meet good friends. Holden makes friends out of people kind of instantaneously, I think. It doesn't take long. Or you can be here a week and then look back and say, hey, we've been friends for a week already. You don't quite know that friendship is exploding into the place. And this has been offered to all of us who have come to Holden ever since its beginnings. I can remember sitting in that first summer with Carol and Mary and their deck and listening to the dream of the place. And a lot of our dreams never quite get accomplished, or they get accomplished in ways that are so partial that we can hardly recognize them. But this dream came, didn't it? It came so wondrously clear and into focus. So if I'm glad to go home and see my dogs, it will be also with a loneliness, because I always am lonely when I get back here. Gertrude has to hold my hand and squeeze it much more after I come back from Holden for a while than she does other times. And she has caught on over the years that if I'm up here and she's not here, that I need some extra caressing and comfort. Because there's a kind of a grief that comes, even if you've only been here for a week or two. And that compounds over the years. So that if you come back for the umpteenth time, that grief that you feel in leaving it is much worse than the first time or the second time. Well, all right. Pain. Let's start there today. That's not the way this thing should be. One of the most common of the denominators of man is pain. Everybody experiences pain from birth to death. You could, without getting too terribly far out philosophically, say that pain is constant and it's with us in every moment. Every time you take a breath, there's pain in your life, you're not conscious of breathing pain, unless you've got chest pain or something. But if we define pain as something, the part that is short of perfection in life. So for instance, I'm including now loneliness is one of the greatest of all pains. Huh? It's one of the sharpest, one of those that hurts the most, is loneliness. Or the kind of loneliness that is such a violence, but it doesn't seem like it. It's that loneliness that comes when you are ignored. You've heard the old saying, the best thing that you can do to a human being is love him or her. The next best thing is to hate. But the worst thing you can do is neglect and abandon and ignore. To walk in that sort of separation from your fellow humans is a horrible, horrible thing. Well, whether the pain is the kind that I get when I eat sauerkraut and wieners with my Norwegian gastric equipment, which always gives me a bellyache, or if it's a toothache, or if it's loneliness and rejection, abandonment, these are pains. And to some extent, we all have them, don't we, at all times. It's a little bit of each day. If you ask me now if I'm hurting or if I'm feeling pain, my answer immediately would be, no, I feel great today. I was just up high again, up here, and look down over this magnificent sweep of the valley, and it's a great thing. I am feeling no pain, but I suppose if I stopped to think a little bit, I would be able to point out a few things that weren't perfect about this day, Now, give me that pain then is multidimensional and it operates out of all the facets and aspects of our being. So there can be physical pain and there can be mental pain, emotional pain, there can be relational pain, or pain in all the areas of our existence. Another thing that is ubiquitous is that in response to pain, every human being reacts with fear. Pain makes us fear. Well, I should, by the way, tell you that none of this is original to me. All of this comes from people who, over a period of about 15 years, gave me the gift of their agonies in counseling rooms. And at the end of the 10 or 15 years that I was engaged in, mostly in therapy, I did a little summary, and when I did the summary, it came down to this thing that I'm handing you today, but these are the things that people have told me out of their agonies. If you have pain, you become afraid. You become afraid it's going to get worse. That's one of the things that always happens. If you get a little toothache, you're afraid it's going to be a big toothache. God equipped us with the capacity to feel pain. It's one of his blessings. And he hooked on to it this dynamic that multiplies the pains that we have, this dynamic of fear. It's a very useful thing to have this thing in good operating order. Otherwise, you might have a pain. Well, it's good that you've got to sit, that you can feel pain that tells you, hey, there's something wrong, huh? That's important. That's the main chief function of pain. It says there's something wrong. Now, if you're stupid enough to ignore the pain, just ignore it, then fear comes along to rescue you. And fear comes along to multiply the pain. And that's one of its functions. It multiplies it so that you say, well, this is getting worse. I better get that tooth to the dentist before he has to pull it. Now maybe it won't be quite so bad if you just have to fill it. So fear that it's going to get worse makes you take some actions that you may not have taken on the basis of the pain itself, because we have an enormous capacity to tolerate pain. These new pain clinics that are blossoming out around the country are certainly were some of the greatest blessing that we have experienced in this whole medical advance in the past quarter century, about the last 10 years for these things. But let me explain what happens here. You have some pain. Let's say that you have 5 units of pain, if you're going to attach some kind of value to it. Then you've got 5 degrees of pain. If you're a normal human being, this is multiplied by 5 units of fear. That equals 25. You see, it's already much more than you started with. Because fear itself is a pain. That's how it multiplies. That's good. Another way of saying this would be that if you have this much stimulus, you ought to have an appropriate response. Fear being the response here. You're sick if you have this much stimulus and this much response. Now, a lot of people have that. We'll get to it a little bit more in a minute. But let me just say that anxiety, form of fear, very often makes it so that we will have little stomach ache, but immediately assume it's got to be cancer. It's got to be the worst. The fear now. So what's happened here is something like this. You've got this excessive response. It's almost as bad, by the way, if you have it in reverse, but we're not going to take time for that one. You have a great big stimulus and you can't react to it. That's what some people have when they lose a loved one but can't cry or can't experience the grief, because that's all repressed. But we've been on that topic enough, I think. Now, let's just say that, coming back to my brilliant use of figures here, let's say that you got 5 units of pain, but instead of having appropriate response, balanced response, you have 25 units of fear attached to it. Now you've got a whopping pain situation on your hands, haven't you? Great, big one. Let me tell you how it works. My little boy, when he was like that, had discovered the joys of rolling down a hill. And he really worked on me to convince me of that this was the greatest thing that ever happened to humankind, to roll down a hill. I came back home from the seminary one day after teaching, and looked in the house, and nobody was in the house, so I went around the backyard, and we had a steep hill, grass lawn, going down steep toward the pond. And David said, "Oh, Daddy, you is home." And I said, "Yes, I'm home." I scooped him up and gave him a hug, and he said, "Come on and roll with me." And he showed me how to do it. All you do is lie down parallel to this hill, you know, and spin. And it did look like a lot of fun. But I can imagine that what I did that day was kind of look out of the corner of my eye, because they're neighbors. For a full-grown, dignified man to go rolling down a hill with a, you know, that was more embarrassment than I thought I could handle it. So I said to him, "Oh, David, I would like to, but you see, Daddy's got a good new suit on," which was a, that wasn't the reason for it, I could have taken it off. But he said, "Let me show you again," and he rolled down the hill, and about the fourth time when he was rolling down, and I was applauding him for this, he went off course of that, and he conked his head. And he conked it hard on a stone. Gertrude had been making a little rock garden. And he hit it. And he was stunned for just a moment. He hit it hard, and then he stood up, and I was running down the hill, being a father who pitieth his child, hurting just a bit because I knew that he'd hit hard. Heard him let out his scream when he finally got to his feet before I got all the way down the hill to him. He came running up the hill full speed. I held out my arms as wide as I could get them for this little guy, and he went right under them. On up the hill. The jerk. I heard what he was hollering, and he was saying, "Mommy, Mommy." And I was right there. "Mommy." And so I was kind of mad. Went in the house. She'd heard him. She was down visiting some neighbors a couple houses away, but she'd heard this scream. Came running. Scooped him up. Went into a big chair in our living room and sat down with him. Did the silliest thing imaginable. Now here's a kid. He's got a bump in his head and the horn is growing out. And you can almost see it in neon light flashing and throbbing. You know, those things hurt. She takes him and rocks him back and forth. "Oh, Mommy loves you. Mommy loves you." It was just disgusting. So I said, "Well, why don't you do something to reduce that swelling? You know, that kid got a bump." "Well," she said, "you're not busy at the moment. Why don't you do what you think ought to be done?" So she kept on saying, "Oh, Mommy loves you." And I went to try to find some ice, because that's a scientific thing to do. Put some ice on there, reduce that swelling, and doesn't stress the tissue so much, it doesn't hurt the nerve so much, it doesn't hurt so much. That's what ought to be done. Well, we're a pastor's family, you know, and getting an ice bag isn't all that easy. At least it wasn't for a while. We didn't have these morning after headaches, things that you use these things for very often. So we didn't have one of these ice bags. But I got a towel, and I banged away at the ice things. We can put a man on the moon, but have you ever seen a good way to get ice cubes out of a refrigerator? You know, at least these tray things, they're horrible things. But I banged those, and ice went flying around, and I filled up a bath towel with enough ice to put this kid in a deep freeze for the next 6 months. Came running in there, you know, with this thing, and it's taken me 5-10 minutes to get it all assembled. No kidding, I'm not exaggerating. The bag was much bigger than the kid's head, you know. came running in there just in time to hear him say, "I will go and roll some more." And I hadn't even gotten there with the ice yet. All right, now what had happened? It was obvious that that thing hadn't stopped hurting, huh? That was hurting, if anything, a little bit more, because the swelling had increased. But Mommy had said, "I love you, ice or no ice." And the kid had the courage to handle his pain and go out and thought he was going to roll. He thought better of it when he tried to do it again, because that was pretty sore. But see, the fear had been taken out of this when his mother said, "I love you," simply because perfect love casts out fear. Even imperfect love casts out fear. If you ever get yourself trapped into a situation where you have more pain than you can stand, with this multiplication factor making it intolerable, find somebody who can effectively love you, and you've got a way to reduce this multiplication factor by taking away the fear, and you're left with the pain, and you can stand almost any pain that life can throw at you. We have an enormous capacity to withstand pain if it is not multiplied with the fear. Now, sometimes the multiplication factor that's here is hard to find, because I can account for the fact that I've got pain if I eat the sauerkraut and spare ribs. I can understand that I've got this amount of pain and I'm afraid now that it's maybe get worse before I get the mailbox or whatever. But what if I can't figure out where all of this fear is coming from, particularly if I've got the 25 units of fear multiplying 5 units of pain, and I say, this is absolutely unreasonable. Where is it coming from? Let's just say that I assume if I get a pain in my stomach, that it's got to be appendicitis, or it has to be cancer, or something. Or I get a little pain in the back, and assume that I've got a kidney stone. Kind of the worst. I don't know if you've ever had a kidney stone, but that's the worst. That's the worst. Sometimes fear forgets what it's afraid of. And we call that repression. You take uncomfortable things like hostility, particularly if you're raised in a Christian home and you're taught that God doesn't want you to have disrespect for your parents, but you find yourself hating. I can tell you something about every one of you. You all hated your mothers, every last one of you. You probably loved your mother a whole lot more than you hated her, but you're not capable of perfect love. There's always the imperfection in these relationships. But if you were not allowed to understand and to know and to feel and to express some hostility for your mother, if there were, in addition to whatever other prohibitions put upon this, the Word of God says you can't do it, then you can get in kind of bad shape. And sometimes psychiatrists make a whole living out of dredging up some of this stuff that we haven't been permitted to show. It's called repression. It works simply. It's easy to work. You can try it. If you want to experiment a little bit, well, half of you in this room hear alarm clocks and half don't. That's just about the way it works out with most populations. Half the people hear alarm clocks in the morning and half of them can't. The half that can't came by this in a very simple way. I know the secret of it, and if anybody would rather not ever hear an alarm clock again for $50, I'll give you the lessons that will make it so you'll never have to hear those evil contraptions again, ever. You can just sleep blissfully right through them. All you have to do is, for 5 or 6 or 7 mornings, if you're not as sharp as you ought to be, it takes maybe 8 mornings, but certainly if you're normal intelligence, 6 or 7, some people learn it in 4. We set the alarm clock, let it ring. When it rings, you simply reach over and turn it off and roll over and go to sleep. Then the unconscious mind, which is the only mind you have when you're asleep, catches on and says, she doesn't want to hear this thing, don't wake her up. And the unconscious mind serves us exceedingly well. If the baby cries two doors down and just a little whimper in the middle of the night, the mother hears it right away. The alarm clock can go off right in her ear and she passes it by if she's had this $50 course that I can give you, or has caught on to it herself a little earlier. Now why? Well, the unconscious mind holds some things down, says some things to us. This thing is something that you don't want to deal with, you don't want to hear, you don't have to. This is significant. Wake up. You wake up right away. A strange sound at night will wake us up, but a sound to which we've become accustomed. For instance, we once lived in a house that had a tree outside that should have been taken down, but for the 2 years we lived in it, every time the wind blew, that there was a thump on the side of the house as this thing hit the overhang on the roof. Bang! And it kind of jarred the house. We never woke up after the first few nights on that one. Unconscious mind said, oh, that's just the tree bumping the house. Stay asleep. For some other things, we wake up right away. Put it another way. If you take a piece of wood and sink it under the water and let it go, it comes to the surface on it. But if every time it came to the surface, you pushed it down again, after a time it would become waterlogged and stay down there. And that's kind of the way repression works. Let's say that I have hurt somebody and I feel guilty about it. I've been unkind or inconsiderate or insensitive to somebody. So I say to myself, I must talk to her about this. I must, apologize or ask forgiveness for this. It's a terrible thing that I did. But maybe not right now because I think she's busy. Or she's not having a very good day, so I think I'll wait until tomorrow. Tomorrow comes. The unconscious mind offers this thing up and says, okay, tomorrow is here. Do you want to talk to her about this now? Yeah, but I got a headache this morning. Whatever. I don't think I will. Not today. Or I'm too busy or something. Making all kinds of excuses, rationalizations, for pushing this thing down and not dealing with it. And after a while, the unconscious mind says, this guy doesn't want to do this anyway. Why keep bringing it up? So it's buried, alive, and toxic. That way. That's where a lot of this 25 energy comes from, to multiply a 5 pain. It is taken up out of what we call anxiety. And anxiety is fear that doesn't remember what it's afraid of. Maybe a whole bunch of accumulated garbage that we have not dealt with in our lives. Ah, man, if we could only practice that health-giving exercise of daily renewal. Wasn't it Al Rodness that said it was kind of like a wheel on a cart? It rises up out of the dirt and it comes up in the beautiful sunlight and maybe drops off the dirt and stuff, but sure shooting it down on the bottom again, picking up the stuff again. It's kind of like that. You go to bed at night and say, God, look back on this day. Forgive me, cleanse me, heal me, and then you wake up in the morning, got a brand new day, and you dirty it up sooner or later a little bit, don't you? But Al said something kind of interesting about this. While this is going on, that you never make any progress, taken from the vantage point of the axle, it's a horribly boring thing. You know, every day you have to be renewed. But taken from the vantage point of the cart, it moves by this and moves on. If we knew how to make this a reality in our lives, the rhythm of this experience of God, this renewal day by day, then we wouldn't have as much of this anxiety stuff to bug us from now on. Half the time gone and one-fifth of the business. Another thing you can say about pain, I said now that always fear attends pain. Always hostility comes along with it. No exception. It is a part of the pain experience. You have to take pain apart a little bit and you find that it's compounded out of pain and hostility. No, fear and hostility. Now the reason for this is simply that we don't want this kind of intrusion into our tranquil life. Babies are born with this. Give them a wet diaper and they squeal their head off and they turn purple with rage. Huh? Stick them with a diaper pin. No, they don't use those anymore, I understand. See, these kids these days have got it made.
They do.
If they use cotton diapers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I hope they do use cotton diapers. I don't like to see all this
plastic
stuff. That's a horrible thing to do to a human being, is to wrap them in plastic. No. Well, anyway, take a let's say that I walk down with my grandson down the street, and we trip over an unevenness in the sidewalk. And we both fall and we both skin our knees about equally and then we stand up. It wouldn't be surprising if the grandson would kick at the sidewalk and talk about this naughty sidewalk. But I would sure feel stupid doing that. So I never do. Never. No, I do it a different way. I would say, how can it be? How can it possibly be that we pay all of these taxes and those stupid guys running this town can't get the sidewalks in decent shape? Or if my grandson bumps into the table in, let's say, the dining room table and bumps his head, he's apt to talk about the naughty table that hit him. Primitives do this when they're walking through the forest, and through the rainforest, and they trip over a log. There's a spirit within the log that tripped them, moved it up. It's just basic to the way in which we function as human beings. Now, if I bump that same table, I'm not going to stand there and kick at the table or say, naughty table. All right, then I'll say, Gertrude, why in the world does this table have to stand right in the path where I like to walk? I'll project this out somewhere or another, huh? Well, you get what I'm saying. If you're hurt, you hate. It's automatic. You just resent the pain. And in resenting it, you seldom take responsibility for it. You usually project this out to something else or somebody else. The primitive does it by attributing it to actions of spirits, good or evil spirits. Some of us more sophisticated will blame it on the government or whoever. But hostility attends. Now something else happens as soon as you feel hostility. As soon as you feel hostility, you experience fear. There we go again. Back to fear, which then multiplies pain, which then increases hostility in a we're starting to build like a snowball going downhill. This is universal. And this multiplication factor is operative in response to the hostility as it is to the pain. There's a good reason for that. That's for self-protection probably too. If I act hostily towards you, let's say I fall off and hit you, if I've got any sense at all, I'll duck. I'm afraid you're going to hit me back. Anytime you have hostile feelings, you're going to fear retaliation. It's a part of the way we're wired up. And it makes awfully good sense. Hostility is wrong, you see. It is wrong to be hostile. God wrote this out in some interesting statements. It was codified into statements that were on the two tablets of stone given to Moses. You shall love God, and you shall love your fellow man, if you're going to summarize it a bit, into the two tables of the law. It says you're supposed to love and not hate. And in our catechism, some of us learned that the law came to us in two ways. On Mount Sinai, it was given to Moses in two tablets of stone, but at creation, it was written in the hearts of men. And this is what I'm talking about at the moment. We haven't paid a great deal of attention to that prior giving of the law. At creation, it was written in the hearts of men. What it's saying in that catechetical statement, catechism statement, is that we are equipped with an intuitive awareness that it is right to love and wrong to hate. It's a part of the equipment of human beings as an intuitive or intuitional thing. It's there. It's automatic. So if we violate the law of God, we fear retaliation because hell stands there in front of us, knowing if you're going to be guilty of this, we're coming to the word guilt in a moment, but if you're going to express hostility, you're going to have to fear retribution. And if you are knowledgeable about, well, I guess in almost all the world's religions, there's a hell of some kind. For the Hindu, it may mean hell is getting born too many times. You gotta work it all out, this karma, until you can achieve nirvana, a great hope, nothingness, out of existence, to be united with the universe, whatever. Another interesting thing here. Whenever you feel hostility in response to either your intellectual awareness that it is wrong, and then some emotional clothing that you dress it up with or enhance it with, or if it is out of the intuitive part of knowing that it is wrong to hate, because God wrote this awareness in your heart at creation, whichever way you feel guilty, guilt always comes. There's some people can kind of numb this reaction. But that numbing is a form of repression, and it only builds up this anxiety business over here again. It's dangerous not to deal with things that are negative. Guilt. Why in the world? Well, simply because God wrote in our hearts that it's wrong to hate. I remember reading Fraser's Golden Bough, which I suppose still remains one of the great classics of literature of anthropology. Fraser, in this volume of magnificent anthropological works, states this thing very eloquently and spends a lot of time on it. This phenomenon, universal, ubiquitous, to all peoples all over in all times, they have reacted to feelings of hostility with feelings of guilt. But Fraser says with one exception. There's one exception to this. And he kind of puts it as the exception that proves the rule. The Papuans of New Guinea. He said, these are the exception. The Papuans are cannibals. And the, says Fraser, and they are, were, are. They sometimes eat people. And he says that they can do this, go through their ritual of, or go through the cannibalism, and they don't seem to show any guilt whatsoever. But Fraser was wrong. The Navy decided that I ought to be down there and discover this. That was wrong. They placed me there during World War II. Mud, Milne Bay, New Guinea. I went into the Navy because my grandfather and my father and a couple of brothers had all come out of infantry, muddy, in various wars or military service, and I was going to be the smart one in the family, so I joined the Navy so I could be clean. And the Navy put me in the dirtiest or muddiest part of the globe, Milne Bay, New Guinea, for 2 whole years. I still rankled. My pride was hurt too because I bragged so much to my brothers that I wasn't going to get walking through mud like they had to do. And here I got the muddiest of all. But I was there only about 3 days before a fuzzy wuzzy came out of an Australian dump truck. These are small people. But they have enormous heads of hair, these Papuans. Enormous heads. It's the kinkliest stuff you ever saw in your life. Fun to put your hands and bounce your hands in this thing. It's really soft and nice and really great. And some of them I got to know well enough so that they would come around and put their heads up, so just because they knew I enjoyed doing this. But it was fun. These cannibals also were very kind to me, and I'll touch on that in a minute. But this one kid came out of a dump truck. The Australians had recruited a lot of these guys to work in the area that we were in, do some road work and some other stuff. And they came in dump trucks, and the dumps, sides of the dump trucks were about as high as the shoulders on these fellows. So when you looked at the truck, all you saw was hair sticking up a foot above the side. It was a strange sight. Then they opened up the tail of this thing and all this hair came dumping out. They jumped out the rear end. And one of the kids lit with his knees bent and stared right at me and came running over and in one of these ridiculous Aussie salutes. Me a Jesus boy. And I was delighted to hear it, but couldn't understand how he came running over here to me. I had nailed up the cross over the door of my office just the day or two before, and he had spotted that, and he was overjoyed. He'd come out of an ALC mission, the old former ALC, that was over at the hill at Buna, on the other side of the mountains where we were. And that's where he'd come from over there when the fighting had started. The school that he was going to over there, this Christian school, had closed. So he came back to his own village, and then from that he was recruited to help the Australians with some maintenance work around the base. Well, we got pretty well acquainted, and after a month or so and a lot of finagling, I got permission to go up to his village with him to see his parents. His parents were sort of open to the idea that their boy was a Christian, and they were kind of toying with the possibility they might want to be Christian themselves. Their grandparents, the boy's grandparents, were still alive. And we got into the longhouse where they lived, and which is, that's an experience. Longhouses have no doors and no windows. They're very dark inside. The reason they have no doors or windows is that they want to discourage intruders, like people from another village down the way that may be hostile. So if enemies are going to come in and raid the longhouse, they have to get on their bellies and crawl underneath. And the pigs, I should have told Leo about the pigs are the sanitation department in these things. The people live up on platforms that are about 4 feet off the ground, poles, right? So any scraps of food and things drop down between these poles and on the ground, and then the pigs feed in there. And it's quite an experience to crawl on your belly and slide through the pig pen on your nose, getting in there. Besides that, I'm not quite built like a semi-pygmy, which these people are. So it took me a little bit more wiggling and squeezing to get under this little one-foot opening at the bottom of the wall. Ventilation is taking place up under the eaves there, about a foot gap also. Well, we talked with these people. They were very cordial and very friendly to me. Bothered me a little bit that they had hanging on the post right alongside to the little part that this family lived on. There were some bones that were unmistakably human hanging there. And we did talk a bit, because the boy was quite anxious for me to talk to the parents, who he hoped in turn would talk to the grandparents, that it wasn't right to eat human flesh. He had learned that over the mission school. The mission school may not have learned as much about cannibalism as they should have learned, by the way. It isn't as horrible a thing as it sounds. These cannibals, now they go to war against each other, and then they'll eat some tissue. But if a mother dies, they also eat some of the tissue from mother, or father, or child. And it's a religious ceremony kind of thing. If they'll take bicep, pass around some of this. It's a little ugly to think about, maybe, but and as they eat some of this, they pray for the virtue of that muscle, strength of the arms, or strength of the legs, and fleetness, courage, intelligence, sense of caring. They pray for things like this when they eat some of the organ that they have associated with some of these things. And this is where Fraser missed. He knew something about this other part, but he didn't know that the last thing they do is pass around a bowl of water, and they all wash their hands while they go through a liturgical prayer asking the departed one to forgive them. So they feel guilt. It's an eloquent example of the relationship between guilt and hostility being just automatic. You cannot hate without feeling guilty. If you feel guilty, bring me our old friend again, fear. Well, it makes this good sense. If you're guilty, you better be afraid. Because there's bound to be, this part of the concept of guilt, isn't it? That there's punishment out there, huh? That's as natural in the as anything in the world. If you're guilty, you should be punished. Well, this is a mess, obviously, because these things are perhaps the most common pathology of human existence, this right here. We all experience this. Our lives are robbed of some of their joy, some of their meaning, some of their effectiveness, and certainly a great deal of the health and ability to function appropriately by this operating this way. If you ask psychiatrists, what are the three great destructive things in human existence, they're most likely to come up and say fear and guilt and hostility. Stage three. And the greatest of these, they would probably say, is hostility. Which brings to mind something. Paul said at the end of that beautiful chapter, and now abideth faith, hope, and love, these three. And the greatest of these is love. It is probably not by accident that those three fit uniquely into this formula. Now, take fear, for instance. The opposite of fear is, I suppose, it's hope, isn't it? Fear is a way of looking at the future. Fear is what you're fearing, what is coming next. The next moment, the next day, after you die, or whenever. Fear is a posture, an attitude, as over against what is coming towards you, or that towards which you are moving. Hope is similarly a way of looking at what's approaching and what's coming towards you. If you live in the fear and trembling that something around the corner or something up there is going to get you, and you live in that kind of trembling, you can be all but immobilized, huh, by that kind of fear. But if somehow or another hope has come in here with, after the way has been cleared by love, because it is love that casts out the fear, and that which replaces it is hope. So now you have hope, which is a way of looking at the future. And the ultimate of that for Christians. Well, you can say it in many ways. I am persuaded, or I am convinced, I am absolutely sure that nothing shall be able to separate me from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus my Lord. Surely not death, if you take one of the ultimates. That has been swallowed up in victory. Hope. Well, how about hostility? What's the opposite of hostility? Well, quite obviously love, isn't it? Because you love instead of hate, and that is one of the goals of living, is to move from hostility to love. We talked the other day about chaos. Another way of saying it would be to get away from the chaos of hostility as you move towards this this constructive and healing life of love. Guilt. What would be the opposite of guilt? I looked it up in the dictionary once and it said innocence. That ain't quite right. There's something wrong with that. Because at least it's very wrong for me. I have never been able to be innocent. It's a little hard to come by. And I remember scripture telling me that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Well, there's none good, no, not one. You know, all kinds of statements we've got about this. Because innocence, in this sense, righteousness, is impossible of attainment. Well, wait a minute, that's not right either. Because there's another word that comes in. The opposite of guilt is not innocence, the opposite of guilt is forgiveness. No. We're either guilty or we're forgiven. There's where the opposite comes in. Now, I'm stretching, perhaps playing with words a bit here, but it's not that far. It is in this faith that we live in the forgiveness of sins, which is so central. This is the redemption. Guilty or not, well, guilty, we stand redeemed and forgiven.
Faith is a not a set of doctrines or a set of beliefs or a set of rules. Faith is a relationship with Jesus Christ. If you have it, it doesn't make any difference whether you know the formula of Concord or not, huh? Or ever heard of it. If you know Jesus, sins are forgiven, you have life in this Christian thing. He daily and richly forgives me and all believers all of our sins. Moment by moment, I don't have one sin on me at this moment. It's hard for me to figure that one out. I can think of a lot of them. But in Jesus Christ, there can be no guilt. When our lives are hid with Him and in Him, then we stand forgiven moment by moment, breath by breath, heartbeat by heartbeat. We are forgiven. Guilty as we are forgiven. Let me use the word faith here. Faith and hope and love. And you don't have to be theologically sophisticated to receive any of these or to appreciate the life that comes when fear has been cast out and replaced with hope, where hostility gives way day by day to more and more love, and where the absolute assurance of life in capital letters is given through this faith, which is a gift from the very God who gives us all the rest.